The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So this is an interesting portion. It's really the last stage of, I guess, what you would call beginning. Because, you know, as we mentioned, some of us spoke about this not so long ago. You know, the year began on Rosh Hashanah, and of course, after the year began, then we went into the festival of Sukkot and Simchat Torah. We celebrated the beginning of the Torah, and then we began the Torah with the portion of Genesis of Breshit, and then last week in Parshat Noach, in the portion of Noach, you know, there was a flood. And the world was recreated, so we began the world all over again. And this week, we really begin the saga of the Jewish people. So this is the end of the beginning, hopefully not the beginning of the end. And it's interesting that, you know, we Jews are famous for long goodbyes, but we're also pretty good at long beginnings. So this is an interesting portion, and what's fascinating about this portion is that every parsha has a theme. And you can very often glean the theme from the beginning and the end of the portion, right? And it's very clear, you know, this is the portion of Lech Lecha, of the journey that we take, the beginning of the journey, the purpose of the journey, right? And every story within this portion essentially relates to what that journey is all about. So if this is the appearance really of the first Jew, if this is the first mission statement for the Jewish people, if this is maybe even why we need a Jewish people, then every story in here is intricately wrapped up with what the Jewish people is meant to be. And that holds true for the story of Avram's journey to Israel. It's true of his battle with the five kings, of his redeeming of his nephew Lot as a captive, right? And one of the stories, one of the vignettes, which we've spoken about before years ago, is an interesting piece because it seems to pop in out of the blue. You don't really get what this is doing here. We're in the middle of a big show, and that is the show of bringing God into the world, creating a nation with a mission, you know, the journey of the Jewish people. And in the middle of this whole show, right, there seems to be this little argument. You know, it's like imagine that there's a presidential debate, and I don't know, I'm dating myself here, but, you know, Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter are having a national debate, and the entire country is watching, and they get into an argument over who has a nicer tie. So, it's bad enough that any two people would argue about who has a nicer tie. But if two candidates on live television and all the networks are arguing about who has a nicer tie, then something's wrong. So, this argument, this particular argument we're going to discuss, is silly enough as it is. But when you take a step back and you realize who's arguing, it makes no sense. How could this happen? You know, until I read this story, I always used to think, you know, it takes two people to argue, right? So you walk into a room and two of your kids are arguing, you just naturally assume that both of them have done something wrong, because if either one of them was perfect, there wouldn't be an argument. But that's not necessarily true. As we'll see, Avram doesn't seem to do anything wrong, and yet these two guys are arguing. Or are they arguing? So let's take a look at the story. This story is actually in the portion of Lecha. It's really the beginning of chapter 13, Perek Yud Gimel. And again, some of us have studied pieces of this. I want to take a look at a particular piece and see if we can make sense. So if you have a Chumash, if you have a Bible, Torah, it would be a smart thing to follow along. You don't have to, but you should just know. Future weeks, it might help you sometimes. So Avram gets to Israel. God has given him a mission. Almost as soon as he gets there, it says, Vayihi Rav Baretz, and there's a famine in the land. So Avram basically decides to leave Israel, to go down to Egypt, which is where all the food is, because the Nile River flows its banks even in a drought, and which is, by the way, why Egypt became such a mighty empire back then. And so Avram goes down to Egypt. Whatever happens to Avram in Egypt, you know, if God tells Avram to go to Israel and then he just turns around and leaves, did he pass a test? Did he fail a test? Putting all that aside, he comes back up. Right? Vayal Avram Mitzrayim, this is the beginning of chapter 13 of Genesis, Perek Yud Gimel. Avram comes up with the Mitzrayim from Egypt, hu, v'ishto, v'chol asherlo, he and his wife, everything he had, v'lot imo hanegba, and Lot is with him. Now Lot is Avram's nephew. According to Jewish tradition, according to the Medrash, rabbinic legend, Lot's father, who was Avram's brother, Haran, saw this miraculous occurrence. The king, Nimrod, is convinced that, you know, Avram is going to usurp his power, and he devises this test, and says, you know, he has to be thrown into a furnace of fire, and, you know, because he's a monotheist, and he gets thrown into the furnace, and supposedly he's saved. And Haran is standing by the side of the furnace, and he sees that Avram is being thrown into the furnace. Right? Nimrod, the pagan king, wants Avram to admit that there are many gods. Avram says there's only one god. Nimrod says, let's see how strong your god is. Throws him into the furnace. And there's a miracle, and Avram somehow survives. And the rabbis have a field day with this miracle. There are angels walking around inside the furnace, and whatever it might be. So Haran is basically hedging his bets. Haran says, if he burns alive, I'll stay outside. But if he's miraculously saved, I'll jump in too, because I want to be part of the miracle. So as soon as he sees that Abraham is being miraculously saved, he jumps into the fire as well. Only, he's been sitting on the fence. So it doesn't quite work for him. So he's burnt alive. And he dies. That's a whole discussion what that story is about and why we do that, but okay. Avram, on the other hand, takes in his nephew Lot, Haran's son. And it is this Lot that Avram comes up to Israel with, and by the way, it is this Lot, along with Sarah, his wife, and the family, that he brings with him when they come up to Israel in the first place, before they went to Egypt. In fact, it's interesting, according to Rashi, God tells Avram, Lech Lecha, you go to Israel, and Avram brings Lot along. And at a certain point, God basically says, you know what, I'm not interested in Lot being here. But okay. So, they come back up, right, and almost immediately, Vegam Lelot, right? The first thing that they do, Vayelach Lemasa'av, Minegev Ad Betel, they travel the country, Adam Akom Asher Ayasha Mo'alo Batchila, until they find the exact place that Avram had first put his tent when he first came to Israel. Ben Beit El Uvena'ai, between Beit El and the Ai is basically south of Jericho, and Beit El is due west of Jericho, so basically halfway up the mountain range. Right? And El Makomam is Be'ach Asher Asah Sham Barishonah. He goes back to the place of the altar that he built, the sacrifices that he offered when he first came to the land of Israel. Almost as if to say that he is sort of tapping back in to that energy. He wants to get back to where he was. He views this trip to Egypt as some sort of an aberration, right? And he wants to make sure that that's all it is. Right? Okay. And he offers up sacrifices. And it's interesting that the first thing that Avraham does is to offer up such sacrifices. Right? But okay. So, all of a sudden, right? V'gam Lot ha'olechet Avraham ha'yatzonu v'akar v'olim. And Lot, who is with Avraham, also has flocks and tents. Now, think about it. You know, there's this socialist worker's dream that the day will come when, you know, I mean, this was Hitler's dream even, one man, one automobile, that everybody will have his own house, that everybody will have his own car, that everybody will be economically sustainable. It'd be wonderful. Everybody's rich. So Lot also now has money. He's made a good buck. He's, you know, been to America, alias Egypt back then. He's done some work. He's earned some money. He, you know, had a shepherd's company and went public, everything is great. So you would think that this should be, you know, the solution to any possible strife, because Lot is not dependent on Avram now, because now he's wealthy. But actually, when he has wealth, that's when they get in trouble. V'lo nasau tama'aretz l'shevet echdav. Ki ayar yechusham rav. And the land could not tolerate both of them dwelling therein, because they had much property. V'lo yechlu l'shevet echdav. And they couldn't sit together. Now that's amazing. Vayhi riv bein roi mikne Avram uvein roi mikne Lot. There's an argument, some kind of a debate, a riv, whatever that means, between the argument between the shepherds of Lot and the shepherds of Avram. And we're not sure where that comes from. What is that argument about? They have an argument. And And the Canaanites are in the land. And on a certain level, that's Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter arguing about a tie. I mean, they're surrounded by Canaanites. The only reason they've come to the land of Israel is to see if they can create an ethical society, but to be the light under the nations. They get back up from Egypt. They want to leave Egypt behind. What's the first thing they do? And they start arguing. They can't live to each other. There's not enough parking spaces in the street. So, Vayoma Avram Elod, now what would you expect? I mean, think about it. You're in an argument, you're in a debate, you're in a struggle. The struggle is not just with some stranger, but your cousin, your nephew, right? Your uncle, your brother. So you sit down, you say, let's work it out. So, Avram comes along. Al natihi miriva ben yuvenecha. Let's not argue, let there not be an argument between you and me. Uven ro'ai uven ro'echa. And between my shepherds and yours. Ki anashim achim anachnu. Because we're brothers in the end. Halo kol ha'aretz lefanecha. The whole land is before you. I mean, you've got, you know, think about the way it was 4,000 years ago. There was plenty of space in the land of Israel. Hi pared na mi'alai. Separate yourself from me. Do you understand this? Avraham, the great progenitor of chesed, of loving kindness, the paradigm par excellence of harmony and unity, has some kind of argument over land and says, okay, let's split up. So that's terrible. What about let's get together, let's be able to do this, sort of both of us together. And he says, if you will go left, I'll go right. And if you go right, I'll go left, which is a pretty strange statement, because obviously if you go left and I go right, then if you go right, I'll go left. But okay. So now you're Lot. Now, this must be a devastating moment for Avram. Avram has no sons. He's well into his 90s. He has one nephew that he's adopted. And he thinks that's going to be his heir. And his nephew starts to argue with him. And he says, look, I don't want us to be in an argument, so we'll split up. So what do you think Avram is expecting Lot to say? He's expecting Lot to say, what are you talking about? Split up, you're crazy. I love you, you're my uncle. No. Vayisa Lot et enav. So Lot lifts up his eyes. Vayar et kol kikar ha-yarden. And he sees the entire Jordan Valley, kikula mashker, which is all fertile ground. It's all well irrigated. Lifnei shachet Hashem et stone. This is before God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Gan Hashem, ke'eretz Mitzrayim bo'achatzor. It's like the Garden of God. It's like the land of Egypt. Do you understand this? Lot sees land that looks like the land of Egypt. That's what the verse says, right? We're in verse 10. Pasuk Yud. In other words, Lot may have left Egypt, but Egypt has not left Lot. Lot still wants to be in Egypt. So what does he basically do? Vayivchal lo Lot et kol kikar ha-yarden. So he chooses to live in the Jordan Valley. Vayisa Lot mikedem, and Lot leaves from the east. And remember that the east is where Avram was. Vayipardu Ishmael achiv, and they separate, man and his brother. Very strange. What is this all about? What is this argument? And what is this doing here? Avram yashav be'eretz Canaan. So Avram is living in Canaan. V'lot yashav be'arei kikar v'yel ha'atzdo. And Lot is sitting in the valley, and he's got his tents pitched till Sodom. V'anshei Sodom ra'im v'chata'im l'Hashem. And the people of Sodom are evil and wicked and sinful and whatever. And now comes the last pasuk, the last verse. V'Hashem amar el Avram. And God says to Avram, acharei he pared Lot me imo. After Lot separates from him, Sana einecha ure, lift up your eyes and see. Mina makom asher et Hashem, from the place that you are. Tzafona v'negba v'kedma v'yama. Look to the north, look to the south, look to the east, look to the west. Because I will give you, says God, ki at kol ha'aretz asher ata ro'e lecha etnena. U'lezarecha ad olam. I will give you this land forever. So that's very interesting. First of all, I understood that this was the deal God gives Avram when he first gets here. How come he has to repeat it now? Second of all, Why does the Torah tell me that God makes this renewed promise to Avram that the land will be his after Lot leaves him? And what is this doing here? Why is this such an important story? I mean, what, every time guys argue we have to put it in the Torah? What's that about? So, there are a couple of ideas that come to mind here, right? There's a very strange Rashi. It's a very strange Rashi. Rashi is the, you know, sort of commentary par excellence in the Torah, and Rashi has a very strange comment. I mean, there are a number of comments that Rashi makes, but this one is the strangest. Why does it have to say that God makes this promise to Lot after Acharei Pared Lot Mimo, after Lot separates from him? Obviously it's after Lot separates from him because we just read it. So it's obvious that there's some process that cannot unfold until Lot leaves. It was time for Lot to leave. So what is that about? So Rashi says an interesting thing. He says, you know, Kol Zman Sheharasha Imo, as long as this wicked boy was with him, the communication with God was out of reach. He couldn't talk to God. Because God said to Avram when he originally wanted him to come back to the land of Israel, Lech Lecha, go yourself, or for yourself. But he didn't say to him, go with Lot. So he took the bullet out. And what's going on here? Why is it, essentially, right, that God communicates or recommunicates to Avram when Lot is gone? I would have thought that this is a magnificent idea. Here you have a nephew. He's obviously having a difficult time. He lost his dad. He's struggling. Avram takes him in. I would think that that's the paradigm. He takes him with him down to Egypt. He takes him back up from Egypt. All of a sudden they're arguing. Avram says, maybe we shouldn't be together. Lot says, okay, I'm out of here. God says, good, now he's out of here, we can talk. What's going on here? So I want to tell you something interesting. Why is this portion at the beginning of the story of the Jewish people? Why is it that Avram says, you know, I don't want to be in a state of argument with you? I think maybe what's going on here is that this story is all about how we deal with conflict. And how we deal with conflict, how we stand for our principles on the one hand, but avoid the possibility of conflict on the other, is one of the most essential pieces of what Judaism is all about. First of all, Avram says to Lot, you know, it's interesting. How does this happen? What's going on with Lot? So if you look at the order, okay, when they come back up to Egypt, from Egypt, from the famine, and Egypt is sort of the empire of the day, it's basically like you're coming back to, you're coming back to the Kotel after having spent an afternoon in Times Square, right? Egypt is not the place where you study Torah. Egypt is, you know, Times Square. Egypt is the party strip, right? So they come back up from Egypt, right? And when they come back up from Egypt, what does it say? It says, Vayal Avram Mitzrayim, Avram comes up from Egypt, he, his wife, all that belongs to him, Velot Imo, and Lot's with him. But when you look at the verse, when they go down to Egypt, at the beginning of the portion, in chapter 12, verse 7, verse 5, Pasuk Hey, Vayikach Avram et Sarah Ishto, so Avram takes Sarah, and Lot, his nephew, Lot ben Achiv, and all their property, and all the people that they made in Haran, whatever that means, and then they go, right, to the land of Canaan. In other words, before, when they make their first journey to Israel, Lot is listed right after Avram's wife Sarah. But after they've been to Egypt, Lot is listed after the property, after the animals. Why is that? Something happens to Lot in Egypt. Right? The order gets reversed. And that's because Lot essentially changes. And while Lot comes back up from Egypt physically, mentally, spiritually, a part of him is still there. And that's why he sees the valley as being similar to the land of Egypt. In fact, what's interesting is, when the human being is listed after the property, it also means that property is more important to that human being than life itself. That's what he's about. He's immersed in the world of how much and how many. So this is an interesting challenge that Avram now has. Something's wrong. And what are they fighting about? Rashi notes the verse, it says, V'akanani v'apriziyaz yashavaretz, and the Canaanites are now in the land. They're dwelling there. Why does the Torah have to tell me the Canaanites are in the land? Because that was actually the source of the debate. According to the Midrash, the shepherds of Lot are grazing their flocks right near the tents. And Avram's shepherds say, you know, you can't do that. Those flocks, this land isn't ours yet. So it's stealing. It belongs to the Canaanite shepherds. So Lot disagrees. Avram's shepherds say, how can we live with thieves? And that's what they're arguing about. And when you take a step back, the argument is really, it's a little strange. This is the big issue. This is what they're arguing about. Except, of course, if you stop to think about it, right? The real question here is not just who gets the land, but what the land is meant to be. You see, if the shepherds of Lot are essentially saying, you know, this land was promised to Abraham, as Rashi points out, and so therefore we are the descendants of Abraham. Lot is the descendant of Abraham, the only living child, nephew. So this land is going to become ours. So if this land is going to become ours, then we can graze on it. And of course the shepherds of Avram say, no, that's ridiculous. That the land isn't ours yet. It says, V'akanani v'apriziyaz baretz, the Canaanites are still in the land. They're still in the land. So if they're still in the land, it means that we have not yet inherited the land. You understand? It means that we have not yet inherited the land. Right? And this is such a strange argument on a rational level. Unless, of course, you stop to think about it. You see, the shepherds of Lot, and I guess conversely that means Lot himself, the shepherds of Lot are basically saying, right, why do we need land? We need land so we can graze. The land of Israel is not the goal. It's just a vehicle. Avram's shepherds are saying, no, you don't understand. The purpose of that land is not so we can graze our flocks. Because the land is not the vehicle. The land is part of the goal. What do I want the land for? And I guess I would take it a step deeper. Because even according to the shepherds of Abraham, the land is not the point. It's also a vehicle. But the question is what it's a vehicle for. Right? You see, if the purpose of land is so that my flock can graze, then basically land is supposed to give to me. And what I believe is that I have the right to take it. It's given to me so I can take from it. But the shepherds of Avram say, no, the purpose of land is so that I can become a nation that's a light unto the world and have an opportunity to give. So the shepherds of Lot are all about taking, and the shepherds of Avram are all about giving. Do I want the land for what it gives to me, or do I want the land for the opportunity that it affords me to give others? And of course, this is bound up in the question of whether I know what I want. And then, of course, you deal with the whole question of dealing with conflicts, which is an essential piece of Judaism. It's interesting. Avram says, "Al na tehi miriva beini uvenecha." Let us not be in a state of miriva. Now, riv, vayhi riv, and there was an argument, that's a state of argument. And that bespeaks the fact that you want one thing and I want another thing, and therefore we're in conflict. But miriva is an air of argumentativeness, but we're not actually arguing yet. Because Avram refuses to allow there to be an argument. And says Avram, we can't afford to be in a state of argument. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal when a conflict comes your way that you don't want? We're living this question, right? What Israeli, what Jew anywhere in the world wants to be doing battle in Lebanon? What Jew, what Israeli soldier wants to be bursting into homes, looking for terrorist cells in the middle of the Gaza Strip? All we've ever wanted was to be left alone. I remember this past Pesach. So, you know, this week's Parsha Bite is going to be dedicated to a very special person. We were in Pesach. We were in America. And on the way there, we decided we wanted to, you know, broaden our children's horizons. So we used a little frequent flyer mileage, and we stopped off in Amsterdam on the way to America, right? And I had never been to Amsterdam, and I always wanted to see Anne Frank's house. So we went to Anne Frank's house, and we went to the Jewish Quarter, and we saw a lot of interesting things from a Jewish perspective, right? And, you know, around the corner there's a magnificent synagogue. It's actually the synagogue that was the synagogue of Spinoza for a while. And it's this incredible building, beautiful, you know, 1700s, just a magnificent shul, which is almost empty on Shabbat because, of course, the Amsterdam Jewish community is almost gone. I mean, there is a Jewish community there, but relative to what it was before the war. And, you know, we asked, there's a Jewish museum there, and then we asked, are there any more sites of interest? And they told us, well, you know, the Jewish quarter is right near here, and around the corner and down the street is actually the building where the Jews were kept until they were transferred eventually to Auschwitz. So I thought this was an opportunity, you know, to see something. And, you know, we were with our kids, and Dorit and I debated it, and we thought, okay, it's not like going to Dachau, so they can handle it. So we went walking through the streets of Amsterdam. No one knew where this place was. Finally, we found it, quite by accident. It was a theater. And it was an old theater. It wasn't even a Jewish theater, if I'm not mistaken. But when the ghetto was set up in Amsterdam, it became the Jewish theater. Okay? Because there was a Jewish acting troupe, and Jews and non-Jews, Gentiles, were not allowed to fraternize. And therefore, no Gentiles were allowed to go to these shows, because the Jews were there, so therefore it was pretty much a Jewish theater. And one day the Nazis came along to the Amsterdam ghetto, and they collected 800 Jews, and then 4,000 Jews, and then 500 Jews, and just every day, until they emptied out the city of Amsterdam. They kept them in this theater for 3 days and three nights. There's a photographic exhibit there, which the captions are all in Dutch, but you don't need captions to understand what's going on there. I remember standing with my daughter, who pointed out to me she had never been in a place where the Nazis were. And to be standing above this central courtyard and to realize that you're standing in a place where 60 years ago, hundreds and hundreds of Jews were rounded up by the Nazis, that was just a powerful feeling. Mostly because you're standing in a theater. And it just seems so incongruous that in the middle of something that represents culture and civilization, that human beings could descend to such barbaric brutality. And, you know, went to Anne Frank's house. Anyway, we get to America for Pesach. And I was sitting at the table on, I don't remember, it was Friday night, or night of Yom Tov, whatever it was, or in Shul, and I started telling over the story. And I had forgotten that one of the individuals sitting at the table had actually been, you know, he grew up in Amsterdam. And on the night of Pesach, on the day that I was telling the story, was the night that the Nazis had banged on the door and dragged his family away. And of course, that was the last time he ever saw them. And he eventually ended up in the camps. And I remember we got into this discussion. And it's interesting, there are very many survivors who absolutely refuse to go back to the places they came from. I know that my wife's grandmother, who was from a very illustrious Jewish family, the Epstein Halevi family, the Torah Tamima, the Aruch HaShulchan, they came from the town of Epstein. And her great uncle, the Torah Tamima, was a tremendous Torah scholar. Actually ended up dying in the ghetto of Pinsk, but at least at an older age, in his 80s. And eventually they had like sort of a 50th anniversary, you know, trip that the city of Epstein arranged for her German citizens and their Jews who were now overseas, because they were paying reparations and whatever else it was. And she had actually not been in the camps. She had worked in Germany until 1938 when she finally managed to get out. So because she worked for a number of years as an adult, so she was entitled to German Social Security and whatnot. Anyway, they sent her this thing. They wanted her to come. They wanted the village to come back. And she decided to go just so that she could see her mother's grave. Mother had died when she was a girl. She wanted to, she hadn't been to pay her respects in a long, long time, obviously. So she went. So she got off the plane, and she went straight to her mother's kever, to her mother's gravesite. And from there, she walked into the town of Epstein, and she went down to the street where she had grown up. And the way she describes it, she gets to the street, and from the street you can see, through sort of a narrow lane, the rear garden, the back garden. And in that back garden is a swing set. And that swing set is the very same swing set, with the very same green bench and the very same chains. That was the swing set she grew up on as a child. That was her swing. And she saw these two little blonde Aryan kids playing on her swing. And she couldn't handle it. Here was a family living in her house, where her parents had lived, where her family had lived. And they never bought this house. It was taken. She couldn't stand to stay in Germany another minute. She turned around, found a cab, went straight to the airport, and flew back to Israel.
sometimes in this world, hipared na me'alai. How do you deal with conflict? Sometimes you have to just let go. You have to step away. Al nata'im yiriva. Let us not be in conflict. And it's interesting that we're going through a situation like that, that the majority of the Jewish and maybe even the world population, whether they're right or wrong is an interesting question, has arrived at the conclusion that the solution is that we have to split up, that we have to separate ourselves. We have to create a separation fence, and we have to create borders, because we can't live together. Could be. Of course, what's interesting is that there is one noticeable difference. In this instance, it's the one who's causing the problem who has to leave. Right? Sometimes you have to know when to separate, right? Especially when we're still in anger. Do you separate from a bad thing? Right? And the other piece of this, which is fascinating, is that if you look in this dialogue between the story of Avraham and the story of Lot, there is one noticeable thing that is missing. Right? Don't know if you noticed this, but what's missing here is the dialogue. There's no dialogue. There's an argument, especially if you look outside of Rashi, there's an argument. And the shepherds seem to be arguing according to tradition. And Avram comes along and says, let's not be in a state of argument, let's split up. If you want to go this way, I'll go that way. Lot looks out, chooses the Valley of Stone, but he never speaks. And that's fascinating. Because I wonder if what that means is that Avram understands there's no one to talk to. There's no dialogue. And when there's no one to talk to, there's no way to resolve the crisis. This is also one of our biggest challenges. Do we have anybody to talk to? And on a personal level, if you think about it, these are the most significant rules of human awareness, of human conflict, of human relationships. To understand the source of a conflict, what's the real source of a conflict? What are we really arguing about? To understand that sometimes we need to separate if one of the parties is not willing to live together. And to understand that when there's no one to talk to and there's no dialogue, then you can't stay together. Because ultimately the bridge in this world is all about dialogue. It's all about staying together. Right? And that may well be the reason that this story is included in the book of Genesis, because that's part of the mission of the Jewish people. The mission of the Jewish people is essentially to be a bridge for that dialogue. To create that unity, to create that harmony. To be a vehicle for bringing God, to bringing Hashem into the world, so that ultimately there is a common ground for dialogue. Right? And that's why Acharei pared Lot meimo, only after Lot splits up from Avram, is God ready to begin the journey with Avram. And it's interesting what Rashi says. Rashi says, God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha, you go to Israel. You have to start this alone. But Avram takes Lot. So you have to wait until Lot leaves. Because Lot wasn't meant to be part of this equation. Now, by the way, it's interesting that Lot does, in a certain form, eventually come back. Because when Lot eventually is forced to flee Sodom, and he and his daughters are saved, but they're convinced it's the end of the world, so the two daughters, sisters, get their father drunk, and they basically sort of have relations with him, and become pregnant, and propagate the world. Now they don't know that there's a whole big world out there, they think that the world is over, just like the flood. Because what do they know? They've never seen such a destruction when Sodom is destroyed. So the fact that they have the faith to want to repropagate the world is an enormous thing, despite the challenges in the story. And one of those two children, whose grandfather is also their father, if you think about it, one of those two children is named Moab. And from the nation of Moab comes Ruth, the Moabites. And from Ruth, of course, comes the seed that eventually will become David HaMelech, David, Mashiach, redemption. So Lot eventually does come back, but this isn't the time. That's a big challenge. You know, sometimes you walk into your house, and before you know it, you're in the middle of a conflict, and you're not quite sure how you got there. Like, somebody had a bad day, right? How am I in this conflict? Where is this coming from? So you got to look at this story really carefully. Do we need to take some space? There's a lot of ways to give people the gift of space. Right? space to vent, space to be heard, space to be apart, right? All of that from sort of one perception, right? And essentially, that's the message of this story of Avram and Lot, right? And of course, sometimes you have to know if there's no one to talk to, you know? Can never speak out of anger. That's a general rule of human nature. If you ever find yourself sort of offended, you're in an argument and you're angry, know that there's absolutely no point to your communications. Of course, it's easier said than done. Always wait until you're not angry. In fact, Rav Tursky used to say that his father, when his father would get really upset with them, so there are two things that I remember. One is that he used to say, the worst thing you would ever hear him say is, may your bread be soft and your butter hard. Like, that was as bad as it got. Which is a pretty serious curse if you're really hungry, right? And the other was, he would tell his children, you know what, I'm too angry to deal with this. I'll talk to you later. Now, sometimes you have to feign anger, right? But you can never teach out of anger. And essentially, I guess the message here is that the Jewish people are meant to be alone in the first stage of their existence. Because they have to be a light, because they have to be visible, because they're going to be choosing a different path. But from that aloneness, eventually will come oneness. And we're going through an interesting period of time. We're sort of wavering back and forth. On the one hand, we've been accepted into the community of nations, and yet on the other hand, we're still a pariah amongst the nations. And whereas solving the opinion of the rest of the world of Israel is a much, much too difficult or very challenging ideal, at the very least, we can be together amongst ourselves. Al natehi merivah, let us not maintain a state of conflict. Let us find ways to bridge those gaps, and let us find ways to be together. And you hear at some Bezrat Hashem that we should merit, you know, to find the kochot, the strengths to resolve the conflicts that challenge us in this world.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.